The following is a production of Art Trap Productions, brought to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you. This episode also brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/podshock for your free audiobook download. Live from Madame Nostradamus' House of Yarn, it's Doctor Who Podshock.
Doctor Who Podshock.
Okay, well, let's do it
now.
Whatever it is, if it's valuable, send it to us.
For the best in all things Doctor Who, it's Doctor Who Podshock, the podcast all about Doctor Who, the longest-running science fiction television program, with Lewis Trapani.
Hello.
Ken Deep.
Hello.
James Norton.
Hello.
News.
Fabulous.
Reviews.
Oh, no.
And fan mail for James.
40,000.
Doctor Who Podshock from the Gallifreyan Embassy.
You know, that guy James was really cool. Oh, yeah, we blew that.
I'm the Doctor, and who are you? Who are you?
The Gallifreyan Embassy, celebrating 25 years of time and space, presents Doctor Who Podshock episode...
Hi, Lewis, Ken, and James, and all the Podshock listeners. This is Dave AC, one of the co-hosts of the Cult and Collective podcast, and occasionally a guest host on Podshock.
What's going on in here?
I'm doing something private. Do you mind?
Were you recording something for another podcast again, Dave?
What I do on my own time is none of your business. I was just talking to my other friends, Lewis, Ken, and James.
Oh, I see. Yes, the other employer.
I mean, I wasn't trying to leave you out of anything, Ian.
I suppose you were recording something for their 200th, huh?
Well, you see, I remembered. I mean, I knew that the guys had, you know, how good they are and what they're doing, and I thought, Dave AC, I'll pop them a line.
Well, I don't know why you didn't involve me. I mean, I have been listening since episode 10. I bet it took you 9 tries to just get that far on your recording. You'd be lost without me, Dave.
Is there a spy camera in here? Have you been watching? That's exactly right.
Well, it's 8 o'clock for me. We can record something if you like. I mean, I'm available.
Well, it's a lot later for me. I mean, really, I was just in the privacy of my own home. I was just talking to friends.
Yeah. In other words, this isn't Jim Jams again, folks. Let's get down to talking about Podshock. Lewis, Ken, and James, you've done a wonderful job. We could listen to them 7 days a week if we could.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know you're known as the Sixth Doctor, but even my friend Ian likes it.
Yes, and he's been listening for the past 5 years.
Oh, yeah, and I forecast a long and healthy future for it.
You guys are most definitely the three who rule.
Oh, where have I heard definitely. That
before? Yeah, can't be important.
Well, that's what the two of us say.
So, on behalf of everybody at the Cultum Collective, and from Dave and I, of course, you're the number one podcast.
Urgent subspace communication incoming.
Hello, this is Michael, host of the Tin Dog Podcast, and I just wanted to say congratulations to Podshock for reaching show 200. Well done, guys. It's been absolutely great listening to you all these years. Here's to the next 200. Be seeing you.
The other mind has now left the Matrix.
Hey, whoa, it's... You're right, it's episode 200. Thank you all. Thank you, obviously, Dave A.C. Cooper and Ian Bissett from the Cultum Collective and Michael, the Tin Dog, from the Tin Dog Podcast. On behalf of Ken, James, and myself, thank you so much for... your greetings and acknowledgement of episode 200 of Doctor Who Podshock. And Ken will be joining us shortly. And as we record this, James is a bit ill, so he may or may not be in this episode. But fear not, this episode is special regardless whether or not it's episode 200 or not. It was going to be a special episode anyway. But being that it is episode 200, it's special on its own right. And we have a couple more special episodes coming down the feed soon. Next month is the 25th anniversary of the Gallifreyan Embassy. We've been celebrating it all year long, so we hope to have some sort of special episode for that. And also this summer is the 5th anniversary of Doctor Who Podshock, so expect something special come that time as well. Lots of celebrating going on here, Doctor Who Podshock and the Gallifreyan Embassy. It's hard to believe it's a quarter century already that the Gallifreyan Embassy sprang from the primordial soup that was, well, actually from the soup that was in between my ears, that gray matter. It's amazing. But we'll talk more about that later. In honor of that, we're going back 25 years, actually maybe 26 years, to an interview that was conducted around that time. It was at the time of the launching of the Gallifreyan Embassy. It might have been the year before, 1984, with Tom Baker. Yes, friend of Doctor Who Podshock, Jules Burt. You may remember Jules Burt. He was in a very early episode of Doctor Who Podshock back in 2006 when was it maybe 2005? We had him on the show when he was working on the set of Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel. And he's been a friend of Doctor Who Podshock ever since. We had him on the show last year as well. He's been a longtime Doctor Who fan, in addition to being in the actual program itself. He's been a fan longer. And he, along with his friend Duncan Skinner and Martin Pook, had an interview with Tom Baker. Yes, the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker. And you'll be hearing that in this episode of Doctor Who Podshock. But wait, there's more. We also have coming up an interview with Mianna Burning, who was Scooty in Doctor Who, The Impossible Planet. That's with the Tenth Doctor. That was in the same series as Jules Burt as well, the same year, 2006, with Billy Piper playing, obviously, Rose. Plus, we have an interview with Victor First Morrington, who's one of the owners and one of the most prominent people that you do see visible on Second Life when we do have our meetups there. And we're having another meetup next weekend, so we want to get him on board and learn a little bit about Victor and Second Life. So it's an exciting program all around, so let's get to it. This is Louis Trapani, and as I said, Ken Deep will be joining us shortly, and hopefully James Norton will as well, depending on how he is feeling. We all wish him well here at Doctor Who Podshock. And if he's not in this episode, you'll be hearing from him shortly, perhaps during our live show this Sunday. And to that point, a programming note for our live show this Sunday, reviewing Episode 7 of the new series of Doctor Who, Amy's Choice. This episode, just like last week due to Mother's Day, now this week due to a Who York event taking place in New York with Sylvester McCoy, we have to move the show up to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, making adjustments to wherever you are located in your time zone. So it's taking place at 4:30, and once again, it's limited to 1 hour only. We have to cut it off, and we have to head over to the Who York event. Ken and I are heading there. Billy, a.k.a. the White Robot, will already be there. And Tim, I believe, is going. Tim Grogan, who you've heard on our show. He's a longtime member of the Gallifreyan Embassy. So we're all packing up and heading over to Who York in New York. But get in the queue early if you'd like to get into the show. And, of course, Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers will be bumped up in the queue. So if you are a subscriber and we don't know your screen name as of such, please let us know and we'll bump you up in the queue and you'll have a better chance of getting on the show. And if you don't get on that live show, fear not, you can always send us feedback using our various means of sending feedback to us. And if you go to our website, you know, I know some, we always say it on our episodes, but sometimes it's, you know, if you're driving, you can't really write it down or whatever. Go to our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net. Both will bring you to the same site. And on the top there, there's a, there are various, menus that you can choose from, and one of them is feedback. If you choose that one, it will give us, will give you your feedback. Well, we'll give you our feedback information. There's the Podshock public call box, which is 206-600-6517. And you can call that 24 hours a day. It's a voicemail system, and it's in the 206 area code, which I believe is Washington State. So just be aware of that. If we don't charge you anything for it, but your phone service may. So, but many of these mobile phone services have, you know, free minutes and units and whatever you want to call it. And you can just call and leave a message there for possible inclusion for feedback. You can also record your feedback. Just many of these, speaking of mobile phones, many of these smartphones now have an option to record voice, and you can record a voice memo and send it via email to feedback@podshock.net. We just ask that you keep the feedback down to a couple minutes, you know, 2-4 minutes or so, whatever. We do have an option for Skype. You can leave a voicemail message on Skype. The screen name is PodShock. The only problem is that we don't always get the Skype messages. We go there, it appears in Skype, and we go to play them, and nothing, you know, it will say, oh, well, it's a minute and 25 seconds or whatever, and we go to play it, and nothing plays. It's just, it skips. It just, like, all, it's obviously, Skype doesn't retain him for that long, and we don't always get to those messages right away, so sometimes they seem to disappear, even though they're still listed there as new messages. So it's a Skype issue there, and so that's why we really recommend calling the PodShock public call box instead and using our feedback address, feedback@podshock.net. Since this is an audio podcast, we always prefer audio feedback whenever possible. So you can always leave us your feedback review if you like. If you can't get into our live show while we're recording it, you can always find out about our live show by going to our website, thegallifreyembassy.org or podshock.net, and we usually have information posted about the live show, the upcoming live show, a couple days ahead of the show. We record the live shows on Sundays, which is the day after Saturday when the BBC releases the new episodes. So, and then we do our live show on Sunday. So if usually around a Thursday or so, we at maybe the latest Friday, we have the information posted on our website, details about the upcoming show and how to participate in it. There's a lot to cover in this jam-packed episode of Doctor Who PodShock, so let's start things off with our interview with Liana Burning right after this.
Hi, this is Liana Burning, and you're listening to Doctor Who PodShock.
What's that? It's a sonic screwdriver. Never fails.
Drop the sonic device.
Isn't my day, is it?
Even the sonic screwdriver won't get me out of this one.
Are you seeking Doctor Who news? The Sonic News Driver. Selected Doctor Who-related news stories delivered sonically. All in a bite-sized podcast. No bigger than a jelly baby.
This can function as a sonic blaster, a sonic cannon, and a triple folded sonic disruptor. Doc, what you got?
I've got a sonic Well, never mind.
What?
It's sonic. Okay, let's leave it at that.
Disruptor, cannon, what?
It's sonic. Totally sonic. I am sonic to
a sonic what? Screwdriver!
The Sonic News Driver. Find it on iTunes or go to sonicnewsdriver.com.
Who has a sonic screwdriver?
I do!
The Sonic News Driver. Get yours today, sonically.
Neat, isn't it?
And we're back on Doctor Who PodShock. Ken Deep alongside Lewis Trepanning.
Hello.
And joining us across the Great Pond, our special guest, Liana Burning.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for being on the show today. Liana was in the probably one of my favorite Doctor Who episodes of all time, The Impossible Planet, as Scooty, and had probably the most memorable death scene in almost all of Doctor Who, I would say.
Which, wow. I mean, that's
the amount of effort that went into your demise in that episode is legendary.
Well, the episode we're talking about is The Impossible Planet, and it's an important story because not only was Liana in it and did a wonderful job in it, but it also introduced the Ood, which is a returning alien that we see throughout the Russell T. Davies era. And because of that, that's going to iconic in that sense. So now, Liana, you have the privilege of being in this story that people are always going to go back to see the origins of, you know, when the Ood were first introduced.
Absolutely. No, I know. I'm well aware of this. The Ood were fantastic as well. I mean, incredible creatures. So, yeah, no, I feel very privileged to have met them and seen them and seen them in the flesh, so to speak, as well.
Well, let's start at the beginning. How did you wind up getting the role of Scooty early on?
Well, I auditioned for it, and then I'd auditioned for The Girl in the Fireplace for one of the parts in that. Mm-hmm. And then I got called back to audition for the Impossible Planet series with James Strong. And I remember I was in Ireland doing some kind of workshop or something for young filmmakers, and got a call saying, you've got to fly back, you've got this job. And I was so excited. I didn't really know a lot about Doctor Who prior to this, apart from this sort of, you know, mystical kind of series that had a huge following. That's kind of the extent of what I knew about. However, I remember being so excited to get the job. And when I rocked up on set, that's when it hit me what a massive thing Doctor Who was and what an incredibly special thing. And I think I said to you, Ken, earlier, that's kind of when my love affair with it started. And so I'm very grateful personally as well to have got the job, because it means now I can really enjoy something that is as special as Doctor Who.
So is it safe to say you're a fan now?
I am a fan now, yes, absolutely, absolutely. So I've been invited to a couple of conventions, and when I go, I almost feel like a bit of a cheat, because I feel like I'm one of the fans going, as well as being invited to sort of to speak about my experiences. So.
But that's sort of common now, since the series has been going on since 1963. You can't, you know, unless you're, you know, at an incredible age, you cannot help but be at a fan already, you know, and be involved in the show.
Yeah,
it's sort of it's a cultural icon. So
absolutely, absolutely.
It's an international phenomenon as well. So no matter where you're from, I mean, people either know it as a cult classic or in the UK where it's an institution. Let's talk about you mentioned how blown away you were on that first day. Can you bring us back to that day a little bit and give us some recollections? You've been cast, you're kind of excited, you get there, and you said that this first day really kind of blew you away. What was that? What did that day entail?
Well, the main thing that I remember was walking onto the set of the TARDIS, which, honestly, I defy anyone to walk onto that set and not be hugely impressed. It's magical. I think it's just as magical as when you see it on screen. It's just the imagination behind it, and the love and the care and the attention to detail just explodes at you. And there's a special buzz about it as well. Obviously, now with sort of bringing the series back to life, I think Russell T. Davis did a fantastic job with that. It's kind of made it alive for a new generation, and there is a huge love of it, and there's a huge family atmosphere on set. And from what I gather, that's what the new Doctor and new team are finding as well. And that's something you don't get on every job that you do. That's really the primary thing that I remember. And then obviously it was quite a big thing over here with David Tennant getting becoming the new Doctor. And I'd had the privilege of being driven to Glastonbury by David earlier the summer previously, just when he'd got the job. And then to sort of see him on set on this massive, as you said, iconic set, mm-hmm. representing, yeah, this amazing institution was really, really special. So that's sort of what stood out for me.
So did you know David Tennant prior to getting the gig?
Yes, very briefly. We had mutual friends, and mm-hmm. I needed to get to Glastonbury, and he was driving to Glastonbury. So very kindly, he gave me a lift. So,
and he said, you'll never believe what I just got.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. That's actually how it went. And then I rocked up on set and went, oh, my God. Amazing. Amazing.
You mentioned that there's a sense of family, and there's a sense of pride amongst the people in the crew that they were working on Doctor Who. This is different than many gigs that you get.
Yes.
A lot of times it's just a job for many people, but this seems to be, you're not the only person to say this, and it means a lot to fans to know that, because there are times when actors or directors or writers or whoever will say that just for the sake of saying it, but it doesn't seem that way with Doctor Who, and that seems to be a common thread.
Absolutely. It's definitely true. And what I think is quite special as well is that, you know, because obviously Scooty was, you know, Scooty died quite quickly, really, but as you said, spectacularly. But there was all of us sort of guests on the episode. We were allowed to become part of that family. very, very quickly. And I think that's also very rare. It doesn't always happen. You sometimes feel that you just, you know, you arrive, you do your job and you leave. And that wasn't really the case. We were allowed to have ownership of it as well. And I think just as much as fans are allowed to have ownership, I think the crew and all cast involved are allowed to have that. Maybe that's what is the sort of special ingredient about it. And I think that's what they wanted when they restarted the series. I think they wanted to create that feeling and that atmosphere, and it was very important, and I think they've achieved it.
When you say that you had ownership over it, where does that come from? Where does that extend from? From the director, from the producers, from David?
It extends from absolutely everyone, all of them, from the producers to obviously the producers extend it to the directors that they bring on board. The directors then extend that further on to their cast and their crew. Constant crew members who are there all the time extend it to new crew members who come on board, you know, for a couple of days or to fill in. It comes, it sort of seeps, it starts at the top and then seeps all the way down to the bottom. So, which is, yeah, very, very special and very rare.
As someone who's worked on different television and film projects, how common is that? Is that half the time, less than half the time, all the time? When you have a set like that, something so comfortable?
In my experience, I think it's very rare. I mean, that's not to say generally the film and television industry are... It is a very lovely industry to work in. Most people who work within it are people. If they weren't, and if they're not, really, I don't know why they're working within the industry. So usually there's a certain sense of camaraderie and involvement. However, on that show, I just felt that it was sort of one of the main things that everyone working on it felt was important to uphold. More so than other things. Certain other things, you walk on set and you have a real sense of in jokes or like a little private world that you can't really crack as a guest artist. Whereas on this job, I didn't feel that at all. I felt that, you know, our input and us as personalities and people were just as important as, you know, as anyone else. And I felt the same from sort of crew members. I had a friend that I'd known from school time who ended up coming on board and working I believe he was working as a loader on the B camera unit. And he came in for a couple of days and even he felt really included. And, I'd say it's rare. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's, I think most jobs try to be inclusive, but to be as inclusive as on Doctor Who, I think that is rare.
Mianna, just a comment about what you had said before about your character having died early on in that episode. And it is true, but you have to understand that your character actually has a presence throughout the whole story, because even after your character has since passed, you're spoken of. And so it plays a pivotal role in that story. Many times you will see a ancillary character that, you know, is oft in the very beginning and you never hear from him or her again or whatever. But your character does maintain a presence. So, you know, it does have more significance than any other, you know, ancillary type of character that does. But what I wanted to ask you was this.
I love you, Lewis.
Was had obviously for fans, this was something that the Impossible Planet was a story that we welcomed, because there were a lot of Earth-based stories taking place at that time, and we were longing for something of a more, you know, space epic. And this delivered on that promise, and it was fantastic. And I have to imagine that the walking on board the sets were amazing. And just what was your experience? And have you had an experience before this of a similar nature, working in a sci-fi themed show or movie? And when you watched it, were you impressed? Because a lot of it had some helping of CGI and special effects afterwards.
I was hugely impressed walking onto the sets and hugely impressed afterwards as well, because I think the sets were just fantastic, and then I think what they added on in post just took it to another level. You know, I remember when we were filming things, for example, when I was looking out and seeing, I've forgotten his character's name now, but when he was forming into Satan was sort of taking him over. Mm-hmm. You know, that was all green screen, and we were sort of shooting it all on a green screen in this massive studio, and then seeing what they did with it in the final production was just incredible. And equally, like you said, with, you know, with obviously with Scooty's death, that was unbelievable. Because
had
shooting,
you done anything like that before? Wasn't that shot underwater?
It was shot underwater, yeah, in Pinewood Studios, where they've got a huge underwater pool. And that was a mind-blowing experience. I'd never experienced anything like it. And it was
scary,
so
I imagine,
much,
right?
Well, no, it was great. We had Mike Valentine, who was our sort of underwater cameraman on that, mm-hmm. who's just incredibly experienced, and his wife, who works with him as a sort of first when they do shoots. And his team, they're just so calming. They have such a calming influence. And I think I was so excited. I didn't have time to be scared. And it's just, it's a quite a lovely experience, because you can't see anything underwater, you know, so you're meant to open your eyes and you can see absolutely nothing but sort of slight shapes moving in front of you. And it's just warm, and I could have stayed under there all day, really.
Well, the final product was, it all paid off, because it was an amazing scene.
Oh, that was the thing, because we were all wondering how it was going to work, because obviously they'd put so much time and effort into that one shot. So that was great to see how that panned out. And that was amazing to be part of that as well. That was felt like a privilege again.
How early on did they say to you, we're going to do this thing with a pool of water? Like, did you know that going into it? Or was that something that they explored once things started rolling and they said, we think we have an idea here?
No, that was something that they knew they wanted to do early on. And I think that was when they were planning the episode, they immediately started thinking about how to do that shot, and came up with the idea that they wanted to do it, shoot it underwater. That would be sort of their solution to it. And I think it was a great idea.
It worked very well. It really sold the idea that you were in space.
Yeah. And it was, and again, you know, what fun to do. How lucky am I? I'm blown away. You get to do Doctor Who and you get to do a massive underwater shot.
And something so memorable, too.
Oh,
I mean,
hugely.
For Doctor Who fans, from the day they saw that, and anyone who watches that episode from this day forward, you can't help but have that image stuck in your head, and it's very memorable. And it makes an impression in the episode, too, because the other characters are moved by seeing that image. You know, that drives the story, as Lewis said, in that it really gets the Doctor kind of pissed off, you know, and he's like, okay, now I got to solve a problem. And
the
thing that Doctor Who fans were very impressed with generally in this story is how the characters, outside of the ones that we were familiar with the Doctor and Rose, how believable the characters were. What kind of background do you get on a character like Scooty going into it? Or was it up to you to really flesh it out?
You get a certain amount of background. You get, you know, sort of information about, you know, why they've ended up on this spacecraft, why they've ended up doing their job. But then absolutely it's up to you to flesh it out. And I think all the actors that were involved in that episode as well, I think generally all the actors who end up doing a Doctor Who are great. I think the casting is absolutely fantastic. Very chuffed to be part of that team. I think by choosing actors who, you know, who enjoy and who are good at fleshing out characters, that's how they create that three-dimensionality. And I think that's important for the producers and the directors on the shows. I think it's a mix. I mean, there's a lot of research. I mean, all the writers doing an incredible amount of research, and the characters that they create are usually very well formed and well developed. But then, yeah, as I say, I think they choose actors and directors who will help to push that vision even further and make it fully three-dimensional.
Well, you have a new movie coming out on the Sci-Fi Channel. It airs on Saturday, May 22nd at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and I believe it's probably 9 p.m. as well Pacific Time. They do a different feed. Yeah, a different feed for the West Coast. It's called Witchville. We've been talking about it on the show for a while now. Sarah Douglas joined us on the show a few weeks ago, and now you are here as well. And you play I tried to explain it before we recorded that you are sort of this, how do you say, a henchman, but for a girl. So henchwoman, hench lady, sexy assassin. What do you describe it as?
I think we're gonna go with sexy assassin. I like that.
That works, yeah.
Fantastic. Miana, sexy assassin, Buring. Brilliant. Good. she's an evil. I play an evil witch who gets a conscience and turns good, and decides to help as opposed to kill. And she's also she's got magic powers, which is fantastic. But she also has a penchant for fighting with daggers and applying martial arts. And she gets a kick out of not using her magic all the time and employing her highly tuned fighting skills, which was incredible because it meant I had to learn fight routines, which meant I had to work with one of the top fighting teams, fight choreography teams, mm-hmm. in China, mm-hmm. which, you know, I remember rehearsing with them one day and just literally looking up, beautiful day in the middle of Yixian, which is a county in China, and just going, my God, I am possibly the luckiest person in the world. So, yeah, so very exciting. And then, yeah, working with people like Sarah Douglas, what a privilege.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. It was a beautiful location, China there. Was this your first time there in the country?
It was my first time, yeah. And it was an absolutely incredible experience. It was probably, before I left, I remember thinking, God, it's possibly the one culture in the world that I knew the least about and felt mm-hmm. that I had the least amount of knowledge to kind of even apply, imagine what it might be like. So going there was just incredible.
It does give the project a unique tapestry and background where, you know, so many of these TV movies are shot in Vancouver, Canada, and they all begin to look the same. And it really, you know, puts a stamp on it that makes it look unique to on its own.
I'm glad it did, because I think also because obviously most of our crew were Chinese, and in fact very few spoke English.
So which was that problematic for you?
For me, not at all. I think it made the whole experience a lot more enjoyable. Before I came out, I had a friend whose brother was working in Beijing, and she wrote down a list of words that she said, look, these will be useful for you. And I rocked up on set the first day, and she taught me how to say gao gao xin xin, which means happy, happy. And so I knew nothing. So I turned up on set and just looked at all these sort of quite stern faces, because there's culturally, usually the Chinese, they will take a while. They're very hospitable, very kind, absolutely beautiful, beautiful culture. But usually before they sort of crack a smile, it takes a little while. They want to get to know you slightly better.
Sure.
So I rocked up on set and just went, gao gao xin xin. And then we started laughing, which is obviously probably because I pronounced it terribly. And they went, this silly little girl is trying to make friends, should at least smile. So that kind of broke the ice on the first day. And then there was a lot of sign language going on, and you realize how universal, there's so many ways of communicating with people without having language. So it was great. And I think it added to the experience, if nothing else.
Well, Lewis and I had a chance to get a sneak preview of the movie due to our mutual friend in West Coast correspondent in Ames. And we thought that the movie was just a lot of fun. I mean, it looks like nothing you've ever seen on the Sci-Fi Channel before, as Lewis just mentioned. And I was blown away by you doing the whole fighting thing. I thought your fight scene was just incredible, you know, like, it was so cool. You had this mane of blonde hair coming out of this thing that you were wearing on your head. It was so cool. I said that to Lewis at the time. I'm like, that is so cool. And so I had to tell you about that, because to see that now in the movie posters that you're seeing online and stuff, to see you with as one of the focus characters with your swords and your knives and stuff, and this, you know,
it was. Yes. Yeah, it was great. And I know, you know, because I was just as impressed as you seem to be, because I rocked it. I mean, that is all Perry Teo, our director. He is such a visionary. He's got such an incredible imagination. And he was so specific about all the costumes, all the images, hair, makeup, all of those small details. He was all over from day one. And I turned up in China. We hadn't met before. I'd met Amy at the casting and Carolyn McLeod, our gorgeous casting agent, and just got on with them famously. And then rocked up in China, hadn't met Perry, and bumped into this one of the coolest guys I've ever seen. And he turned around and said, "Hi, I'm Perry, and I want you to look like this in this film." And I went, "Awesome! That's..." Oh, wicked.
Like as if you could have any other reaction to the way that character looks, you know, that it's just this assassin type of thing, you know, but as you say, also a witch on top of it.
And for Doctor Who fans that just know you as Scooty, it's quite a change.
Yes, yes. It definitely is a change. It's very, very different. And, I have huge armor and a huge cloak, and I fly in it, which I think is also quite cool. And that had nothing to do with my acting, obviously. That was just CGI, but still, I love CGI.
You have you seem to enjoy, but in your talking about Doctor Who and now talking about Witchville, you seem to enjoy science fiction and fantasy and some of the stuff that you do. I know some actors, and maybe they come from a different generation of actors, they sometimes looked at it with being a bit snooty about things, that it was beneath them. But it seems that some actors, and I always compliment them on this, when they genuinely embrace it and seem to not mind it and see it for what it is, that it's an opportunity to surround yourself with creativity. Do you feel that?
Oh, hugely, hugely. I think, you know, sci-fi is one of the most creative genres that we have. And I think it's a reminder of how incredibly collaborative it is. All work, all film work, all television work, all theatre work is collaborative. However, I think when a lot of the emphasis is purely on performance, you sometimes forget about everything else that goes into making that performance. Whereas with sci-fi, you're never allowed to forget. And I think that's a great thing. And I think I feel very, very honored that I've been able to do a lot of work like that and to sort of be able to be part of someone's larger vision and to be able to help someone's imagination come to life. I think that's a great thing. And added to it, usually characters like that, you get to learn skills. I'd done some stage combat and training prior to Witchville. However, I definitely can wield two daggers far better now than I ever could before.
And you never know when that may come in handy.
And something to add to your resume.
Exactly. Yeah, don't mess with me, I'm telling you. I don't even try.
Well, Miana Buring, we want to thank you so much for taking some time out today and coming on Doctor Who Podchalk and recalling your experiences on Doctor Who. And Witchville airs on Saturday, May 22nd here in the United States. And watch this space for the international air dates.
Mm-hmm. And
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And who knows, we may see you on Doctor Who again, even though your character died. It's Doctor Who. It's all about time travel. We just saw another character return from the death, from the grave. So,
absolutely, you never ever know. You never know. I'll be there in a flash if that ever happens.
Well, thank you once again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank
you. Absolute pleasure. Look after yourselves. Bye now.
The wonderful Miana Buring. We want to thank her for taking some time out to speak with us here on this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, and be sure to catch her on Witchville. That's premiering on the Sci-Fi Channel on May 22nd. That's a Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central in the U.S. Check your local listings for details. Witchville on May 22nd. It's a drastic change from her character as Scooty from Doctor Who, The Impossible Planet, but just as thrilling. Now, we would like to welcome back a sponsor to Doctor Who Podchalk, Audible. Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, information, and educational programming. Content from Audible is downloaded and played back on personal computers, CDs, iPod players. Just like you listen to this podcast, you can play it and listen to it whenever, wherever you like, just like you're listening to this show right now. Audible has over 50,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered. It has thousands of titles in science fiction and technology, over 1,100 titles of science fiction and fantasy, but it's not limited to that. And what we love about Audible is that it has an extensive collection of Doctor Who titles. And you can make one of them your free selection when you go to audiblepodcast.com/podshock. Yes, you can get a free audiobook download when you sign up for a free trial today. Go to audiblepodcast.com/podshock and get a free audiobook. And it could be any selection that you like. It doesn't have to be Doctor Who. But we always like to pick out a recommendation. What we had been doing is picking out each episode of the Paul McGarry series, Doctor Who, The Hornet's Nest, which stars Tom Baker. And how fitting is that? Because we have Tom Baker in this episode of Doctor Who Podshock. Tom Baker reprises his role as the Fourth Doctor in this series, and it's a series of five, and the fifth is The Hive of Horror. Joining Tom Baker is Richard Franklin, reprising his role as Mike Yates. And it all comes together here in this final battle, Doctor Who, The Hornet's Nest, Hive of Horror. Let's hear a little bit from that right now.
The King Wenceslas last looked out on the Feast of Freedom.
Morning, Doctor.
Ah, oh, Mike. Better for a little wash and brush up, eh?
Indeed. Those creatures of yours and that Whimsy woman can be a little fierce, I must say. I felt like I was fighting for my life just getting out of the cellar this morning.
Yes, it's a good job the dawn had arrived. They're easier to pacify in the daytime. Tea?
Thank you. Now, what are we going to do about these hornet things? You can't go around hypnotizing everything forever.
First things first, Mike. I have here, on the table, one or two pieces of equipment from the TARDIS.
You and that police box. I wondered why I hadn't seen it about.
I've hidden her away from the further attentions of the hornet swarm. She's quite safe, which is more than I can say for the entire human race, should the hornets have their way.
All right. So what's all this gubbins?
Well, this part is the TARDIS's dimensional stabilizer.
Oh.
Hmm. It's currently generating the force shield around the cottage. What are those bell issues doing here?
I used them to swap that bat last night, remember? I say, are they?
Yes, they are. The very ones that were controlled by the group mind of the swarm.
Mouldy old things, aren't they?
Bringing them to the table has given me an idea. I do believe we can use them, in conjunction with all this gubbins, as you call it, to tap into the special powers of the hornets.
I see. Just explain to me what will happen if we don't defeat these insect things. I need to know what's at stake here. Soldier, you see.
Mike, these hornets are alien creatures that can infiltrate and possess anything. Human, animal, living, dead, inanimate. They can bring anything to life.
As we've seen with these blasted stuffed animals. Not exactly world-threatening, though, is it?
No. How would you like to have your every move, your every mood dictated by insects buzzing about inside your skull, hmm? They want to enslave the whole lot of us and make this world into a nightmarish place. Like the last world they wrecked and abandoned. Oh, yes. I've done my research. I know what it means for a world to be attacked by the deadly swarm.
So we're all that stands between mankind and a horrible fate at the hands of insects?
They don't have hands, Mike, but yes, you're quite right. Now, help me to carry this lot back into the parlour, would you?
Another one of your lash-ups. It doesn't look very impressive.
It doesn't have to. The dimensional stabilizer just has to be able to do what I ask it to, tuning itself into the ineffable vibrations still present in this ballet slipper. Here, look after the other one, would you?
Ballet slippers, indeed.
Our biggest problem, of course, is that in using this lash-up, I'd be lowering the defensive shield around the cottage. The stabilizer can't do...
Ah, how good is that to hear Tom Baker again as the Doctor in a new audio adventure, The Hornet's Nest by Paul McGarry, and you can have this for free. You can get a free audiobook download when you sign up for a free trial today. Just go to audiblepodcast.com/podshock and get your free audiobook today. That's, once again, that's audiblepodcast.com/podshock. And we have links to that on our website. So if you go to our website, thepodshock.net or gallifreyanembassy.org, you'll find a link to that as well. But it doesn't have to be this title. It could be any title you choose. As I said, they have over 50,000 titles to choose from. Every genre Audible has it covered. And once again, we want to thank Audible for sponsoring this episode of Doctor Who Podshock. Check them out, audiblepodcast.com/podshock. One Doctor Who book title that's not there yet, only because it's just about to be released, is The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. Now, you may have heard about this book on this podcast before, because Anthony S. Burge, who's one of the contributing authors and editors of the book, has been on the show. He reported for us at some of the New York Doctor Who events, specifically the East Village Cinema event last month. Some exciting news, Doctor Who Podshock will be recording live at an event to launch the book this May 20th. We're very excited about it. We are going to be at Fiddlesticks Pub and Grill, 56 Greenwich Avenue, New York, New York. That's on the 20th of May. It's a Thursday at 7 p.m. We hope you can be there. For more information, go to our website, thegallifreyanembassy.org or podshock.net. This is one of a series of four New York events scheduled around the book release, The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. Joining Anthony S. Burge at this event, along with Doctor Who Podshock, is Jessica Burke, Christine Larson, and Barnaby Edwards, who you know from DWNY in New York, and also maintains a blog with us on our website, gallifreyanembassy.org, along with contributor Melody Green. So mark it on your calendar, the 20th of May at 7 p.m., Fiddlesticks Pub and Grill, 56 Greenwich Village Avenue in New York. And now, with a review of that book, is our correspondent in Germany, Graham Sheridan.
Hello. This is Graham, the second Dr. Sheridan, and this is a special book review instead of my usual German report section. So, here we go. This is a review for a book called The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who. Now, all contributors are not only learned folk, as the term demands, but also in Doctor Who fandom. So, which allows them to put forward their arguments and very well and quote exactly where to. Now, this has nothing to do with being a geek, but as anybody who has written papers for a university-level education knows, this is a must. Otherwise, it makes for nonsensical and badly marked or received papers. So, the foreword is written by Simon Guerrier, known for his work of many things, who, you know, books and such like, and has contributed largely to Big Finish. Also, the Doctor Who New York specialist and organiser, Barnaby Edwards, has written a brilliant preface to the book too. So, to all of those out there who have ever had deeper thoughts about what certain stories has as a meaning, should read Anthony Burge's chapter, The Professor's Lessons for the Doctor, the Doctor's sub-creative journey towards Middle-earth, where such stories as The Celestial Toymaker and The Mind Robber are taken under scrutiny. These have either baffled or just plainly entertained, but they're here, for the first time to my knowledge anyway, is where they are explained. So, a couple of the other chapters. Jessica Burke, that is the wife of Anthony, and Christine Larson take the Valkyrie mythos under scrutiny. And I don't mean just the obvious name that springs to mind when you think of Valkyries and Doctor Who. I'm on about Leela. Expect also in this book to find out where such storytelling, and indeed mythological references, have their beginnings. As your general Doctor Who watcher or public doesn't tend to know where the story has its source. Okay, it may be the fact that they just don't care, But if you are going to buy this book, it suggests to me that you want that expanded knowledge where your beloved programme of choice has its ultimate roots. The arguments laid out by each chapter author are things I've heard throughout fandom, but in this context at least are satisfyingly laid out. Because not only do you get the argument, but you also get the required thought to that argument and why. If there's one complaint about some part of new fandom by the old fandom, such as myself, is that new fans make an argument, but not exactly sure where exactly A, they're going with this argument in question, and B, what they actually mean by their argument. I suppose it's something to do with the way the English language has been highly simplified, even in at least the last 35 years or so, and so the new fan in question is not quite sure how to formulate their argument properly. With the mythological dimensions of Doctor Who, the opposite applies, and it's nice to actually be able to see the arguments going through the stages. That if language is going to survive and going to be much more than just grunts and whistles in the future, then it has to. Also, the mythological dimensions of the Doctor Who book is right up to date with the programming. Well, as far as it has a dedicated chapter to Russell T. Davies' era called Mythology Makes You Feel Something. The Russell T. Davies era as a sentimental journey. Now, this is done by Matt Hills, where Matt looks at what Russell was thinking and what were his arguments for giving us a feeling doctor who's not afraid to show his emotions. Now, this is something that fandom, in its classic sense, had never had in such abundance, and that sometimes had a problem to understand, especially for those who only saw the doctor in terms of black and white. So, the short but well-constructed afterwards by Anne C. Petty rounds off the book nicely. There are also a few pages about the chapter authors themselves. This would normally appear at the back of any book, but with so many authors, I don't think there'd be there enough space for that. But so it was better an idea to put in book itself. Now, in the entire book, there's no chapter that's worse or better than any other in any big sense of terms. They're all equally brilliant. But my favourite chapter has been Life During Wartime, an Analysis of Wartime Morality in Doctor Who by Melissa Beatty. Now, this has something to do with me being an ex-soldier myself, serving the British forces for some 13 years or so, serving in places such as Bosnia as part of the peacekeeping duties there, and part of the force that went into Kosovo in 1999. This chapter I can appreciate because it's something I personally can relate to. So, to top all this off, the cover is by Andy Lambert. Anybody who's out there who uses Facebook and has myself or Ken Deep as friends will know his work, as he makes beautifully created wallpapers for your computer of your choice. So, the book is available for pre-order through Kitsune Books. That's, Kitsune is spelled K-I-T-S-U-N-E, and is available at www.kitsunebooks, that's all one word, kitsunebooks.com/doctorwho.html. If you want to try and get it through your usual book channels, the ISBN number is 978-0-9-819-49581, and is available at the end of May at the time of this recording. So that's my review of this book. I'd say go out and grab a copy as it comes out and enjoy. This has been Graham, the second Dr. Sheridan, doing the book review for The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who.
Fantastic, Graham. Thank you once again. Graham also has a blog. He maintains the blog, just like Barnaby, on our website, thegallifreyembassy.org and podchalk.net, so you want to check that out. Also, we have links to where you can buy the book the mythological dimensions of Doctor Who on our website as well. Once again, GallifreyNBC.org or Podshock.net. We also thank Graham for being a Podshock supporting subscriber, and that keys directly into the book, The Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who, because the publishers of the book have given us a couple copies to give to Podshock supporting subscribers. So similar to what we did with the Blu-ray of Doctor Who, The Planet of the Dead, we're going to be giving two copies of this book to randomly selected current Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscribers. The first to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the Gallifreyan Embassy next month. We will have details shortly on our website about it. Just one of the benefits of being a Podshock supporting subscriber. With a low monthly subscription fee as a show of support, not only will you be helping us continue and grow the show, but you'll get extra content as well. In our most recent extra episode, number 193, we had more coverage of the New York Doctor Who events, including more with Matt Smith and Karen Gillan. We also had more with Anthony S. Burge, giving his final review of the East Village Cinema event. It's extra content like this that you get as a Podshock supporting subscriber. To find out more about it, go to our website, podshock.net or gallifreyanbc.org, and on the top there's a banner to become a Doctor Who Podshock supporting subscriber. Click on the banner and you'll get more information and how you can join and show your support. If you're already a Podshock supporting subscriber, thank you so much for your continued support. It really does make a difference. So now you may be saying to yourself, gee, I would like to attend that Mythological Dimensions of Doctor Who launch party event on May 20th, but it's hard for me to get to New York. I'm nowhere close to it. It's hard for me to get there. Fear not. You can attend our Second Life meetup, which is taking place this Saturday, our seasonal Second Life meetup. And what better way to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Gallifreyan Embassy and the 5th anniversary of Doctor Who Podshock without the barriers of distance? No planes, trains, or automobiles are required. You can just log into Second Life using the free client. All you need is internet broadband access and join us. It's taking place between 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. Second Life time, which is the same as Pacific Daylight Time, since Second Life servers are located on the West Coast in the U.S. It's synchronized to that time zone, so synchronize your own time to that, and hopefully you can join us. We have these meetups on a seasonal basis. They've been becoming more and more popular. So to that end, we have with us a special guest, Victor First Morrington. Now, if you've ever been to one of our meetups, you will know who Victor is. He's not only the host with the most, he's one of the owners and managers there of the Doctor Who experience on Second Life. It's in the land of Katrina. So it's my pleasure to welcome Victor on our show. This is Doctor Who Podshock, and this is Louis Trapani, and with me is Victor First Morrington of Second Life. So we're here, we're actually in Second Life, and I'm talking to Victor here, and Victor is one of the owners here of Katrina, where we have our regular seasonal meetups here for Doctor Who Podshock and the Gallifreyan Embassy. But before we get into talking about Second Life, we're going to talk to Victor generally about Doctor Who and his involvement with the series as far as when he started watching Doctor Who and what drew him to it. So, Victor, you have been, obviously, you're in the UK, and Doctor Who's been a staple, an institution there. So I'm assuming you grew up watching Doctor Who, and who was your first Doctor, and do you remember what your first story was?
My first Doctor, I was a little toddler at the time, so technically my first Doctor would have been John Pertwee, but I was so young I couldn't remember. But my first vivid memory of Doctor Who would be sitting in my grandfather's house, because my grandfather used to work for the BBC, and he really? Was a big BBC man, yeah. He was wow. He never worked in Doctor Who, but he worked for the BBC, and he was a big Doctor Who fan, and I remember sitting watching, I can't remember the episode, I think it might have been Pyramids of Mars. I'm sure it was Pyramids of Mars, mm-hmm. Tom Baker. And that was me. I was instantly hooked. Instantly hooked. Little kid at the time.
Tom Baker was basically, even though John Pertwee you were aware of, but Tom Baker's when you really became a real fan of the series.
Yeah, Tom Baker is when I got hooked.
You've been following the series ever since?
ever since, yeah, even through some of the kind of dismal, appalling years and through the dreaded dead zone, I was reading the novels and watching the comics and all that. But, oh, yeah, been a follower ever since.
The dark times, as it was.
Yeah, exactly, the dark times.
Actually, you know, reading the comics and those, like, third-party adventures, you know, be it comic books or novels and all that, really helped span the bridge when it was nothing there out there to consume. There was no new television series. And basically that's what you're doing here as well with Second Life, is extending that Doctor Who adventure with in a virtual sense, in a 3D virtual reality here on Second Life. And it's incredible. And I just have to thank you for all your help putting together our meetups. We couldn't have done it without you. And people that are just listening to this interview are kind of missing out on the visuals of it, because it's really it's an immersive experience with visuals and sounds. And so before you got into Second Life, did you have any background doing 3D virtual reality at all?
I had background in the gaming industry itself. I used to work for Interplay before they went bankrupt twice, and then I switched over to Activision. But for actual virtual worlds like Second Life, no, it was mostly just the normal PC game industry I was involved in. I didn't even take part in like the MMOs out there, like Guild Wars and World of Warcraft and all that. The reason I went into Second Life is because one day in 2006 I was bored, to be perfectly honest, and I went, oh, I'll try Second Life out. And back then, I mean, Second Life compared to what it was back then has totally changed from what it was back in 2006.
Our first meetup was actually 2006, it was November 2006, and we've seen the differences, and it's incredible. And my history, my background with a similar nature was back in the late 90s, there was a virtual reality type of software called The Palace. And I had used that, and I actually ran a server, a palace myself. Each like server was called a palace. So mine was a Serendipity, and it was a very Doctor Who themed palace. Though it was 2D, it was, you know, using two. It wasn't a 3D virtual reality. It was using 2D to simulate 3D. So it was, I did it for a couple of years. It was very interesting, and it seems like Second Life has grown from that, where it's a 3D immersive experience, and it's really incredible what you have done here. When you started here in 2006, there was obviously Katrina wasn't here yet, and there was we had our first one at Bill Eccleston's land, Land of Doctor Who, I think it was.
Yeah, Barbara Eccleston, Land of Who was the first Doctor Who whole region. It was part of the region, but it was the first attempt, basically. Doctor Who fan, Barbara Bill Eccleston, I think he's no longer in Second Life now, and the first meeting was there. Land of Who closed down halfway through 2009. This region we're in, the Katrina region, was basically a branch off of what Bazzer Bill was doing in the Land of Who. The problem in the Land of Who was they couldn't get the entire region. Now, anyone who doesn't know, Second Life has never been. All plots of land, like if you have a single plot of land, it's normally in a big region. And whole regions are 256 metres by 256 metres. A whole region covers that entire span. And it's quite a big chunk of land if you get a whole region. The problem Land of Who had is it was in the middle of a region surrounded by other people's homes. So he couldn't expand out. And plus, I think what was happening with Bazzer Bill is, eventually, if you spend a lot of time in one single place or one single game, you eventually get a little bit fed up with it. And Bazzer Bill we started to see that, well, I didn't personally, but some of the other people started to see the signs of Bazzer Bill drifting off and doing other things and, you know, just getting on with his life, basically, and real life caught up. And that's why Katrina opened up. They started off, Eze McAlpine, Nodster TARDIS, and Marine Dalek Tomorrow were the original owners of this place. Started off in the corner where the Millennium Centre is now, and slowly took over the entire region, plot by plot. It was like an invasion, but it worked.
Now, you run Katrina along with, was it HBK, if I'm remembering correctly?
Yeah, HBK Schwartzman. HBK is not technically one of the owners, but he's one of the longest members of staff here. There's four owners here. We kind of split the cost between us, between this region and the region next door to us. You've got Eze McAlpine, who does his own thing. Marine Dalek, who's our canon enthusiast. So if we make Daleks, or like the avatar I'm wearing right now, which no one can see because this is a podcast, but right now I'm wearing the Centauran avatar. Usually Marine walks up, makes a little grumpy noise and says it's not canon, so we basically need to rebuild it again. We've got Nodster TARDIS, who's the other builder here. Nodster is the man who basically single-handedly made everything you see on the ground down below. So the Millennium, the Millennium Center, he built it. The floor, all of it, he made it. Most of the buildings, not all of them, but most of the buildings Nodster made. And yeah, it's like me. I'm one of the new owners here. Actually, I was brought on staff in 2008. Became an owner in 2009. And the thing I'm responsible for is the museum, which takes up the entire top floor of the Millennium Center.
Well, you've been incredible, you know, with us and having our meetups here, and you're sort of like the ambassador to Second Life, where you really take everyone by the hand and show them around, and we're much appreciative of that, and thank you once again, and you hold these TARDIS tours when we do have our meetups, and everyone, you're very generous with your time and patience, because a lot of newbies come here, and they don't know, they're clicking the wrong thing, and you have to, like, right-click the TARDIS doors to open up. It's a great thing about Second Life is that, you know, instead of just transporting Star Trek style, you actually ride in a TARDIS. How great is that as a Doctor Who fan? So that's fantastic. And you would bring us to museums and different other Doctor Who themed lands, and it's a massive, I was saying how immersive it is, but it's also a massive experience here in Second Life. And also, just for our listeners, that you had mentioned Marine Dalek, and if that name sounds familiar and you haven't been to Second Life before, you may know his musical work, because I know he's done some compositions, Doctor Who themes, and that you could have heard on Danny Stewart distributes some music on a podcast, and you might have heard some of Marine Dalek's music there as well.
Yeah, it kind of keeps that quiet here, though.
All right. Well,
that's just Marine. Basically, Marine is a kind of quiet person. But basically, if it's not just Doctor Who, though, if you're a fan of science fiction in general, Babylon 5 fan, somebody has made what could basically be called the entire front end of the Babylon 5 station, decks, everything that can, you know, everything's there. The biggest science fiction group is obviously Star Trek. Obviously Star Trek, they get everywhere. But there's even Firefly groups here. People have been building Firefly sims, and there's all
Star
sorts
Wars
of fun
well.
You can do
I've
here.
Seen some Star Wars.
Oh, yeah,
films.
Yeah.
So now, there's speaking of other science fiction, obviously we know you've been a long-time Doctor Who fan. Were you drawn to other science fiction growing up, and do you have other interests in any other science fiction genres?
I used to be, and I still am, a big fan of Star Trek games, because at the time when I was working in Activision in the 90s, they took over the old Star Trek PC game franchise when Interplay was in the process of basically imploding and going bankrupt, and MicroProse were doing the same. MicroProse made some great Star Trek games back then. Activision stepped in 99/2000 and took over the entire Star Trek PC games franchise, and they made classics like Armada, Bridge Commander, all the really, really good games. And at that point in time, I was leaving the gaming sector because I knew things were heading in a direction I didn't quite like, and I went more into the podcast/fansite kind of direction. So and I still run it, actually, StarTrek-gamers.com, but it's a quiet website now because the Star Trek games franchise is, well, it kind of fell flat in its face when they released Star Trek Online. They built up and built up Star Trek Online, and when they released it, everyone knew it was a lemon. It wasn't Star Trek. It was Star Trek in name only, and the Star Trek game franchise kind of died. But it's not just Star Trek. I'm a massive Stargate fan. Love Stargate. Always loved it.
Yeah, I've seen some, obviously, some sims of that here as well. you know, with the big Stargate that you can actually any I guess science fiction medium that you can cross over to other worlds or dimensions is a natural here on Second Life, because that's what you do on Second Life.
Yeah, and that's exactly. But I mean, the Stargate we've got down below, which is usually folded under the ground, but it's got all the whirly whirlpool effects and the TARDIS here. If you're going to be here for the TARDIS tour, you'll see the TARDIS consoles that have been made here, and they work. They work as close as they possibly can to the one seen in the show. Obviously, there's limitations because we're basically inside a game, but they work as close as they possibly can to the ones in the show. And right now, at this very minute, somebody in the hands of Omega Workshop is making the Matt Smith console.
Now, I thought of you because you were, you never have been that quiet about your dislike of the console room of, the 2005 to 2009 era of Doctor Who. And when it was destroyed, I said, oh, well, Victor's going to be very pleased with that. And now you can move on to a new TARDIS room. But now they unveiled the new TARDIS interior. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, that's even more complex, more rendering that has to be done, more sprites and whatever that needs to be created in Second Life. So what's your feeling about the new TARDIS interior?
The new interior is 10 times better than that coral mess that was in the RTD.
So visually, it's better, but is it more complex to be replicated here?
As we don't actually make the consoles here, we sell them for other companies. The biggest one is Hands of Omega, and I was talking to one of their main builders, and I can see him having a nervous breakdown pretty soon.
It's very intricate and complex. I mean, I love the new TARDIS interior, but it's just I can imagine it being a nightmare for someone that has to build these polygrams and what goes into Second Life as far as building stuff. It must be very complex.
It is very complex, but the biggest problem, the next time you watch, or even if you watch one of the old episodes, for instance, like the very first one, 11th Hour, at the very end where they're camming around the console room, look very closely at the walls. Look at the walls, not the console itself. The console can be made. It would be an absolute nightmare to make it, but it can be made. But look at the walls. None of the walls join up with each other.
Yeah.
They go off into the distance and then just stop and fresh air, and then there's the roundels that's deeply embedded inside the walls, the staircases that go through the walls. It's going to be a nightmare making that room. It really is.
Well, I wish them luck, but if they are anything like, you know, they've done in the past, I'm sure they'll come through. It's incredible seeing the TARDIS interiors. You had mentioned before about being involved with podcasts, and I just want to give a shout out that you're involved with a couple of our friends, Nat and Terry's podcast, Dirty Whoers. So you're a regular on that show, I hear.
I'm a semi-regular. I'm basically the token Scotsman. If one of the other if one of the other four presenters can't make it, you've basically got their in-world names is Oolon Sputnik, Terry Lightfoot, Sen Pixie. Sen's the American bloke that's on the show. Sen is the person that's in charge of Hands of Omega. All the consoles that you see that we use in the TARDIS tour are produced and made by Hands of Omega. And Fuchsia Begonia is Terry's very close friend. And if one of them can't make it, they usually haul me out the cupboard and, you know, get me to basically rant and rave about how bad the Coral console is. It's always good for fun.
Well, we should make a note about that for anyone that hasn't been to Second Life, is that when you join Second Life, you get your own Second Life name. So as opposed to your regular name, you choose I think you can choose, if I remember correctly, you can choose anything you want as your first name, and then you pick out of, they give you a selection of different last names to, surnames to use. And I, naturally, when I signed up, so I think it was, 2006 or whatever, some 4 years ago, there was Hartman was one of my selections, so it was offered to me. So naturally, my first name was Two, so Two Hartman is my Second Life name. And if any Doctor Who fan reads into that, you know what that means.
It's very apt. Very apt. Yes.
Anyone that's not a Doctor Who fan is like, what's this guy? They think I'm Asian or something like that because my first name is Two. So, and you're Victor First Mornington. So if you come to Katrina and you see Victor First, usually your avatar is usually one that's quite dashing, and it has a I want to say a little bunny on your shoulder, but it's not a bunny, though. It's something.
It's a rabbit. It's a it bunny a rabbit. Okay. On my shoulder. Thumper.
And that's like a little robot, that something that's a script in Second Life that you have as a little companion, sort of like a pirate.
Yes,
as a bird, you have a little Thumper.
Yeah, basically, it's like if it was a pirate, it would be a parrot sitting on my shoulder. But, you know, I'm a big fan of bunny rabbits for some strange reason. So I thought, oh, that looks cute. So I stuck it in my shoulder.
It is cute.
Don't ask.
Fantastic. If someone's coming to Second Life for the first time and they just want to, let's say, before our meetup, we have our seasonal meetups. We do it 4 times a year. And our next one is this coming Saturday, the 15th. I believe, yes, the 15th. And I recommend anyone to come and join us. What you would need is obviously, a broadband internet connection and a computer that's somewhat modern, somewhere within the last 3 years or so, something that's capable of running the Second Life client software, which is free to download. And they just released a new version 2, which earlier Victor and I were talking, and he doesn't recommend it for builders, really. It has some problems. This is my first time using it so far, but I've just been talking with Victor here, so I haven't really used it that much. But so far, it's all right. But it's a sleeker interface. It's more, it seems to be trimmed down as far as, visually from what I'm seeing. The interface doesn't seem to be as cluttered.
Yeah, it's more like what they're trying to do now is basically make Second Life more user-friendly for the new people that's coming in, because the old client, the one I'm still using because mm-hmm. I prefer the old client, was a little bit on the confusing side for people trying to learn. So what they've done now with the new version 2 viewer, which a lot of you will be downloading, because when you log into Second Life with the old client, it basically begs you to download the new one. It's more like a browser-based look and design with a sliding sidebar on the side, a la Facebook, Twitter kind of thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of the new people are liking it, but if it's just to stand around and chat and have fun, Viewer 2 is the one for you. But if you want to get into some serious building and scripting and basically manipulating objects and world, you're best sticking with the old Viewer 1 right now. For now, anyway, until they do something with Viewer 2. There's been a lot of complaints about Viewer 2, but most of the complaints is the builders.
Did they take away features from builders? Or are there stuff that you have to use version 1 to do that you just can't do in version 2? Or is it that just that version 2 is more cumbersome to use to do that?
It's more cumbersome. They didn't take away. In fact, in some cases, they've actually added a couple of good features. But what they've done with Viewer 2 is bury things under loads and loads of submenus, mm-hmm. which makes building, it makes building twice as long now.
So from what I can gather, what they probably did was to get it away from the casual viewers so they won't be confused by it all and kind of hide it, but it makes it more, what they should do is make it so that if you are advanced, you are an advanced user, that stuff can be brought to the top and you don't have to dig for it. That's what they should do, so that you can have one app and you can choose whether or not you want the basic or advanced, and let the user switch between the two.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, I mean, the viewer is also open source. It's based off of OpenGL. That's the game. That's the engine that's running the client itself. So if you don't like Viewer 2, there's other third-party viewers. They've got to be sanctioned or given the nod and approved by Linden Labs. But there's a lot of good third-party viewers out there if you don't like Viewer 2. But if you're coming into Second Life just to run around, fly a TARDIS and chat, Viewer 2 is fine for you. It's fine. It's only not fine if you want to build something.
Mm-hmm. So if you haven't been to our meetup yet and you want to just kind of wet your feet, and what you might want to do is come and explore Second Life just to get yourself a little familiar with how it works, and maybe build your avatar or dress yourself up with an appropriate Doctor Who gear. Victor can tell us that there's a a mall or a shopping center or a facility in Katrina that you could use to buy certain outfits. And there's some stuff there for free, too. There's, like, boxes that you touch, and you can get different props and costumes and shirts. There's Doctor Who Podshock shirts that you can be had there as well. So isn't that right, Victor?
Yeah, there is. If you're just new to Second Life and have never been to the Doctor Who experience before, when you, whatever viewer you're using, the buttons are generally the same. So when you log in, if it's your first time here, you will be unceremoniously dumped in Orientation Island or Help Island, which doesn't offer you any help at all. So what you want to do... It's true, though, they used to have staff, but it's not staffed anymore. What you want to do is click on the button that says Search at the bottom of your viewer, or if you're using Viewer 2, use the toolbar at the very top, and simply type in The Doctor Who Experience, and a map will pop up with a little button saying Teleport. If you click on the Teleport button, you will land roughly in the middle of the stage right now, because the stage is down there. And if you walk about, or if you land in the middle of the sim, face towards the Millennium Centre. It's just like the one in Cardiff, the big brown armadillo building. So if you're facing the Millennium Centre, turn left and head into the freebie store. And in there you can pick up free Dalek avatars, free unit soldier avatars, and there's a stack of Cybermen avatars in there as well, dating all the way back to the, like, Troughton Cybermen, all the way up to the Cybus Cybermen. There's a lot of stuff in there, and it's all for free. And they look quite good, actually, because a lot of them were made by the staff here.
They're all quite good, and as you were saying, a lot of it, it's all free, so you don't have to spend money here to enjoy Second Life. But if you do want to, there's Second Life has its own monetary system called Linden Dollars, and you can use either the Second Life website or the viewer application to buy more Linden Dollars, and then you can actually buy stuff on Second Life too. But you don't have to if you don't want to. You still can have a fantastic experience without buying anything, but you can if you want to. And when we do have our meetups, we do set up a tip jar for the DJ and for ourselves and for the, Katrina. So it's something that we do appreciate those that can give, but you don't have to if you can't.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know a lot of people that come into Second Life and basically don't spend any money at all. They just come in to socialise, and that's one of the benefits of Second Life ever since they brought in voice chat. It's like a big 3D world chat room where you can just sit back, relax, and basically have fun. Use the public TARDIS. We've got a TARDIS here. Okay, it's based off that coral thing from the other series. But, it's in the museum, so you don't even need to buy your own TARDIS. You can try before you buy, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The one that's in the museum is all scripted. It's the one actually bought from the Hands of Omega shop. All I've done is cut a side out of it to make the door bigger. But, yeah, it's all there. And the best thing is, even if you want to plough money into Second Life, if you look at the way things are priced here, like if you want to get a decent avatar with decent clothes, it's basically the cost of like a couple of pints in your local bar, basically.
Yeah, don't
it's not
be scared
all that expensive,
because the Linden Dollars that there is, it's sort of like almost like Japanese yen. It's a lot more.
Yeah.
You look at it and everything looks very expensive, but it doesn't translate to that much. It's all right. Well,
I think right now the way things are working out, it's like 1,500-ish Linden dollars to $5. So, yeah, it's about like the Japanese yen.
Mm-hmm. So just to summarize our meetups, we have Victor does a, and this is another thing to that you should be aware of if you haven't been here before, is that Second Life also has its own time. It's called Second Life Time, which is basically Pacific. Well, right now we're in daylight time, so it's Pacific Daylight Time, and so that in the U.S. on the West Coast, so that's where Linden that operates Second Life is is situated in that part of the world, so that's why the time is synced to that. So we do our meetups at 1 p.m. Second Life time, and Victor and takes an hour and brings us all on the TARDIS and on board the TARDIS and brings us to all these, gives us a tour of Second Life, and it's great if you haven't been to Second Life before to get a little taste of it. And then after that, is usually about an hour break before our dance party, and that's in the main, well, it's in Katrina, but it's in that Cardiff near the Millennium Center, and it's there's a stage set up there, and we usually have a DJ with live music, and it's just a fantastic time. You don't, if you can't dance, don't worry about it. There's a globe or something, an object that you can click on, and there's a script that will make you dance, so you don't have to worry about, as opposed to real life, in first life, rather. you can dance your heart away in second life. And it's just a lot of, it's a very social, fun place to be. So we encourage you to join us. And Victor, I want to thank you for taking some time out for this interview. It's been a pleasure and a delight. I know we've been trying to get you on board for a while, and just our schedules haven't been meshing. But I'm so happy that I had a chance to, you know, virtually sit down and speak with you here in Second Life, and look forward to seeing you again next week for our next meetup.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Lewis. And yeah, I'll see you all on May the 15th.
All right, fantastic. We hope to see you there on Saturday as well at our Second Life meetup. As mentioned in an interview, we started this in 2006, and we've been doing this seasonally since 1 year ago, since last May, and ever since then, we've been getting a lot of requests to have Victor on the show, so I'm glad we finally were able to have Victor on the show. So as I said, it's seasonal, so every 3 months we have these meetups. So we did it last May, then we did it again in August, and then November, and so forth. In fact, it was last August around that time was the last time we had Jules Burt on our show. Jules Burt, you may remember, who was in Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel. He's been a friend of Doctor Who Podshock, and I'd like to welcome Jules Burt back to Doctor Who Podshock. Hi, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
It's fabulous nice having you back on the show. We had you on, it seems just like a few months ago, but it was actually last summer. I believe last August you were here on your honeymoon in New York, and we had a chance to sit down literally face-to-face with you and have a good time over a couple of ales and record a bit for our show. So how you been?
Oh, it's been really good, yes. Work is good. I can't believe it was, it seemed almost a year since I was last over to see you and Ken at the Doctor Who New York meetup, mm-hmm. which was brilliant, and that's what got me to dig out this old cassette.
And I'm glad you did. This dates back to, I believe, 1984, an interview that you with your friend Duncan Skinner and Martin was
Pook.
Pook, yes, that's right. I wasn't sure. So that's fantastic that you guys had this opportunity to sit down literally with Tom Baker and interview him. Because it's not often that he does these interviews.
No, we were very lucky. Duncan's mother at the time was an advertising editor for the local paper. And through her contacts there, Tom was only down for a week in the theatre, which was quite new then, the Plymouth Theatre Royal, and managed to wing it so that, you know, he met up with basically some fans. And we got to ask him a few questions, which was an absolute treat. Tom had been to Plymouth a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Once in 77, I think he did it again in 1980, doing formal signing sessions in Debenhams, which is a big department store. First time he was even down in costume.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. The second time I got to meet him, and that was absolutely fantastic, but it was a very much, he was just signing Target paperbacks, and I don't even think Doctor Who Weekly had started back then. But this, to get the chance to meet him, you know, when I, as I said, I was only 15 at the time. Duncan was there, and we'd so we'd started a little fanzine called Terminus, which we sold through the Celestial Toy Room Dwas publication. Mm-hmm. It's tape scenes were all the rage back then. We looking back on it now, I mean, I only heard it for the first time in 20 years or so this afternoon when you emailed the copy over to me of the interview. To be honest, it could have been a lot worse. A slightly squeaky voice. And the questions, I think Duncan's were more the traditional, you know, what's your favourite story? And I'm pretty pleased with some of the questions that I asked him towards the end, because, you know, would he come back? Because Colin Baker was doing that story with Patrick Trout. And
well, really, a few of them you caught him off guard. There was one where, were there any, I don't know, negative moments in the show, something along that effect? And there's a long pause, and he goes, you guys have been influenced by the chat shows, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, when I read his biography years later, I think at that time he was... he had just divorced, and I think he was perhaps heading towards perhaps a few rough years. you know, he really was not very happy with the show. You know, I think he just wanted to forget it. But, you know, I think he was beginning to realize it was going to follow him around for an awful long time. It certainly wouldn't be like today where, you know, he's doing commentaries.
Sure, well, this was 1984. He had just left the role a few years later. The year before was the Five Doctors, which he didn't appear in. So,
famous.
Yeah. So you got to put yourself in that mindset. In fact, as you know, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary now. So this goes back to even a year before the Gallifreyan Embassy. So you've been scooped us. You know, we got to meet Tom Baker in 1986. And then he didn't grant us an interview. So hats off to the three of you. I think that's incredible. And you also had this was written up in one of the papers as well. I have a clipping that you had placed up.
That's right. Yeah, that was the paper that Duncan's mum worked for. So they gave us a little piece, which was once again, it was great. And I think it got mentioned at school the next week when it had gone out. And as I said, the Dwarfs covered it, and I think we sold at least 150 copies, something like that. Whether any of them are still surviving, I don't know.
And this was for Terminus, which was a audio show.
Audio fans.
It was basically what we know as a podcast today, but before podcasting, it was instead of being distributed through RSS feeds that podcasts are, you did it on a cassette, you know, analog, and was distributed that way.
That's right. I mean, we used to just duplicate. We'd make a master and then just hand duplicate them all. And the one that you've got there, you know, even the labels were, you know, hand stuck on.
I mean, can see they're coming off a bit. Yeah, I was very careful and delicate with it.
I mean, that was such a golden age back then for Doctor Who fanzines, and a lot of the names you know today. I mean, Paul Cornell did a great one. Mm-hmm. Gary Russell, I think, did Sharda. Plus the official Dwarf one, I think, was called TARDIS. And a lot of those great writers cut their teeth there. There was some brilliant stuff in those. Ours wasn't quite up to that level, but we had a lot of fun putting it together. And,
well, as an audio podcaster, I have to, you know, compliment the you and Duncan for doing the show, especially at that time, just working, you know, with analog equipment. You guys did a great show, and it's on par with podcasts that you hear today.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. It was certainly a lot of fun when we put it together, for sure.
All right, well, we're gonna bring you back to 1984 with this rare classic interview with Tom Baker, and I'm so thrilled to have Jules here with us for, you know, just to introduce you to this interview. It's a real rare treat, and as Jules said, he had sent it to us actually a few months ago. We've been just so busy as of late with the new series and everything that's going on with Doctor Who Podshock that this is our first chance to bring it to you. So what better than episode 200 of Doctor Who Podshock? So thank you once again, Jules. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And on behalf of James and Ken, they also send their regards as well.
Thank you, guys. Excellent.
All right. Well, here's Tom Baker, Jules, Duncan, and Marty, right? Or Martin.
Martin, that's it.
Yes.
How did you get started in acting, and how did you get the part of the Doctor?
I got started in acting thanks to the Germans bombing Liverpool during the war, which kept me away from school. And because of being away from school, we were encouraged to entertain ourselves and entertain each other and other people. And that's how I got started as an actor. As a boy, when I was very small, because often, you know, one can go to school for weeks or months on end. So that's how I got started doing that. And as for Doctor Who, that was just another accident. I was out of work and the job was empty. And I had written an indignant letter, not to ask to do that. And the letter went to a fellow who'd just come away from a casting session. And at that time, there was a picture out that I'd done, I think, called The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which was a special effects picture directed by Ray Harryhausen. And this fellow, having been to a casting session with no idea that he was the head of the department, went to see this film and then proposed me, and then the rest of the department went to see the film.
From there on.
And I was in. Hmm. That was it. It was all done in one letter. I mean, when they, by the time they went to see the film and rang me back, they decided that if I really wanted to do that job, that they would give it to me. And that's how it happened.
Did you enjoy working with the rest of the Doctor Who crew?
With the crew?
Producers.
As long as they agreed with me. I adored working with them. Yeah. I adore people who agree with me. Don't you? I can't stand people who agree with me. They did what I wanted them to do. I adored them. And if they forced me to do what they wanted to do, I hated them. A bit like family life, really. Because sometimes it was good and sometimes it was bad.
Agreeable or disagreeable. Did you have a favourite companion?
Well, you obviously, that's a journalist question, if ever there was one. So well, I answer that, I'm going to offend four girls, aren't I? I did have a favourite companion.
I didn't fuck them in that one, Tom. No?
I did have a favourite companion. I married her.
Who designed your costume?
It was designed by an amazing young man called Jim Acheson, who then went on to do films. And it came just by accident again. We just went out to play. We used to go to wardrobes and try on clothes before he drew any pictures. And because in the ordinary way, a designer has an idea and they draw pictures and then they make up a coat. But we had enough time to go out together to get to know each other. And we used to go out and get dressed up in all sorts of costume departments, the BBC or Morris Angel or places like that. And gradually a sort of figure began to emerge. And then we decided to have a scarf. And Jim had seen a man in a pub with a scarf of those colours, the original colours, just an ordinary woolen scarf. And he wrote down that colour scheme and we bought some wool and gave it to a woman called Vergonia Pope, who had never worked for the BBC before, but she was famous as a knitter, and we knew nothing about knitting either. And when we went to pick up the scarf, we bought too much wool and she knitted it all out. And the scarf went right across the room. And that's how it happened. It was all an accident.
Do you still have your costume?
No. Why should I have my costume?
Well, Louise Jameson kept hers.
But Louise Jameson never did have any taste, did she? I thought her costumes were terrible. No, I haven't got my costumes. I mean, it's like asking if I got my own army costumes.
Do you have a favourite story?
I don't think so, no. You must understand, I used to work on four or six scripts at a time. And a great deal of the time I didn't know what was going on, which I think was an advantage. When you consider the subjects of the scripts. In America, they think that I was very spontaneous as Doctor Who, and indeed I think I was very spontaneous simply because I didn't know what was going on. I was constantly surprised. I didn't much want to know what was going on. I just went from scene to scene, trying to make it compelling and amusing. So I didn't really have a favourite story. You know? I had one or two favourite monsters. Like, I remember Slippery. I used to like slimy monsters or rats. But all those mechanical ones I thought were boring, except the first one, which I thought was amazing, which was the giant robot. That was absolutely amazing. But all the others I found not all that compelling.
Can you remember any really bad mistakes that were made during filming?
Completely corrupted by watching chat shows, aren't you? This is the high point. You know you're almost embarrassing them.
I'm leaving it to them.
Just
don't
move on.
I'm listening.
There must be thousands of them. But I don't think mostly they were rather irritating because one doesn't want things to go wrong. Even on film, it's not like working in a theatre where you rehearse a thing and then it happens. Usually it happens. Because you're on an open stage with other actors, and it's very well rehearsed. In film, you know, you need about 10 factors to come together. So you may do the scene brilliantly, and they say, let's go again, because it was a booming shot. Boom operators never apologize. So the next time, actually, the focus puller didn't get it right, so you do it again. So each time they think the actors should get it right, and the actors do mostly get it right. And then when all the technicians have got it right on the 15th take, the actor is then so overwrought, he forgets a line or a move. And they say things like, can't you get it right, darling? Yeah. And then tempers really flare up, and then it gets very interesting indeed. Go on.
Were there any stories that you disliked?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I didn't feel that strongly about it. No. Sometimes there were incidents and stories that I didn't like, you know, certainly violent incidents. But no, I think I settled. I mean, I was just hired to do acting, you know. I didn't have any editorial.
What happens to the film that you're making, Doctor Who and the Sandman?
Doctor Who and Scratchman.
Scratchman.
Yeah, I was that with Ian Martin and James Hill. Yes, nothing happened to it. That's what happens to most scripts. Nothing.
Were you a Doctor Who fan when the program first began?
No, I wasn't even a Doctor Who fan after I started doing it. The pub was always open when it was on, so I never actually saw it myself. I had other things to do on a Saturday, but I did enjoy doing it.
Do you watch the program these days?
No. As I didn't watch it when I was in it, I'm extremely unlikely to watch it while anyone else is doing it.
Would you appear in the next anniversary special?
When will that be?
So, if there is another decade or something.
Well, I guess I'm alive, I've got nothing to do, I don't mind walking through it for a minute.
Why do you think that Doctor Who has been running for so long?
Because it's a good formula. You must know that answer. Why anything runs a long time? Because it's a good formula. When a good formula takes place, it goes on. Why does This Is Your Life run on? Why did Zed Cars go on? Why did Crossroads go on?
Yeah.
Because in their way, they're all good formulas. It doesn't matter who's in it.
Do you have any tips for anybody who is interested in becoming an actor?
Not at all. I would have thought that anyone who's silly enough to want to become an actor wouldn't take tips anyway, because when you do something like want to become an actor, you're not really being rational. Right? It's such a stupid thing to want to be. Because the chances of any kind of success at all are so utterly remote. I think the unemployment rate among actors is 86%. So the miners or the steel workers or the carpenters have got nothing on actors. 86% are out of work. So your chances of earning a living as an actor are nearly zero, even if you're very good. Maybe especially if you're very good. Because the factors that go into being successful have often got very little to do with whether you're good or not. So I'd say, if they insisted, I'd say nothing, but if anyone insisted on saying something, I'd say, well, I'd just say, no, you're mad. If you're mad, you don't need tips from mad people. You can't advise mad people, can you?
Sure. Do you
still get a lot of attention from Doctor Who fans?
Yes, I do, yes. I was in America a lot last year, where I'm considered some kind of miracle worker, such as the potency of television. So there's an enormous amount of fans, yes.
What do you think of America Doctor Who convention?
Well, I've got nothing to measure them against, really. They're just astonishing. They're so large, exciting, amazing, and silly all at the same time. But just amazing, yeah. Americans take fandom, fandom, I think they call it, very serious.
Do you think you've played the Doctor too long?
I think I probably do everything for too long, yes. But I mean, I used to laugh when I used to go to work, so I thought, I don't see why I didn't give it up. I was enjoying it, but I think probably I did stay a bit too long, really. I think I stayed probably a year or so too long. I did at one time resign, and they persuaded me to renew the contract. But, yeah, it's all right. I mean, I enjoyed it.
If you had the chance to return to the role along with Colin Baker in a current Doctor Who story, would you accept as a talent convenient?
No, I don't think so, no.
Well, at the moment, the next season they're having Colin Baker play for Trouton.
Well, that's fine, but, you know, I can't speak for any of that. You're asking me, my answer is no, I don't want anything to do with it, no. I did it and was very close to it, was the leading man in it, and I didn't want to go back playing a thief to Colin Baker or Patrick Trout or indeed anyone else. I like playing leading parts.
Which control console did you prefer, the usual one or the wooden one?
I hated both of them. I thought they were both absolutely mad. But I couldn't say that when I was doing it, but I hated them, yeah. I hated them all, yeah. I hated the whole treatment of the inside of the TARDIS. I thought it wasn't nearly daring and adventurous enough. But of course, I couldn't say that because I was on contract.
Do you think the Gothis was a good story for you to regenerate?
That was all right, I think. It's okay. Do you think it was a good one?
It's brilliant.
Oh, well. Yes.
You got the answer.
That's all right, yeah.
You think you should have had more stories with UNIT?
No, I didn't think so. I was very bored with UNIT, and maybe I influenced actually the annihilation of UNIT. I thought all those realistic soldiers running around firing guns were very tedious, and indeed I often complain bitterly that the resolution of stories in Doctor Who used to exhaust, since they were nearly always resolved in an explosion. I find that incredibly tedious. That's how you resolve things in this world. If you're thinking of this man from another galaxy, this person from another galaxy traveling the entire galaxy, it seemed to me that there wasn't enough difference between the Earth and those other planets we were on. They're always blowing things up. It wasn't strange enough. I mean, I'd much rather have turned, been much funnier, I think, to have turned the villains into, say, cockroaches, don't you? To actually have made a cake, and these greedy bastards all swallow the cake, and they were all turned into cockroaches. That strikes me as being really, neat, that, instead of blowing them up. And then what happens is they're all scuttling across the street, and you can hear them with the wonderful equipment we've got. And as they're scuttling across some kind of street, some terrible casual people come walking down the street. And then I think that will be fun. The children would like that.
I'm sure they would.
Whose idea was it? The Doctor and the Pescatron? Do you think it was too childish?
I can't remember now whose idea it was. Was that what we made a record on?
Yeah.
But we never did that on the television.
No, it was on the record.
Oh, yes. It was just made for record. I don't know whose idea it was. People are always asking me to do things like that. I've forgotten who wrote it now. But Elizabeth, wasn't she? Yeah. I so liked working with Elizabeth. Because she was the first one I knew then. I never saw Elizabeth, you know. I don't think I saw her once outside of work. Oh, you said it last year in America, in Chicago. Last December I saw her. But I thought she was a wonderful Sarah Jane. Absolutely wonderful. I really liked working with her. But then because she was the first one, you know, I was very biased and she was very kind to me. And when people are kind to me, my judgment goes a bit awry. If people are very kind to me, I get a bit imbalanced.
Like this lot, Tom, isn't it?
Yeah. Right. Any more questions?
Well, that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Are you happy there?
Thank you.
I'm not going to put hard questions to you, Tom. Just tell me, how does it go in the school?
How's the play going? Well, I think with the exception of tomorrow afternoon, we're a sellout.
Yeah, I am. It's
quite a good day. They've been standing in the evening.
Do you reckon the National Theatre could do a lot more down here? Do you think the response is going to go about from our part of the country?
Well, the National Theatre, I think, keeps to its brief. It came down there last year with a stupendous production of Arrivals, didn't it?
Right.
And a bit earlier than that, not even a year before that, it came down with Don Quixote, with Paul Scofield.
I noticed you say Don Quixote.
Well, I mean, I could have
seen... Yeah, it would be
some of the... Yeah, Don Quixote.
That's right.
So I think that Plymouth, this big theatre, because this theatre is as big as the Olivia, so I think Plymouth has had a fair crack at the National in the last 2 or 3 years.
No.
So I was here for Shakespeare, wasn't I?
Right.
In educating reader.
I remember.
So, I think they're doing pretty well now.
Mm.
Mm. But I mean, they also have the drum in there, of course, on a smaller scale.
That interview was recorded at the Theatre Royal Plymouth when Tom Baker was appearing in Oliver Goldsmith's play Two Stoops to Conquer. And we'd like to say thank you very much to Tom Baker for giving up their time.
And thank you, Jules, Duncan, and Martin, for sharing this rare interview with us with Tom Baker. Some apologies for the quality of the interview there. Please realize that the tape was an analog tape from 26 years ago, and it was recorded in a cafeteria there at the theater, and there was a lot of background noise, and they were by a window there, so there was street traffic as well. So we cleaned it up as much as possible. So it's not what you normally expect with today's interviews, but please understand those factors involved. It's fantastic hearing what Tom Baker had to say, especially when you put yourself in that mindset of 1984, which it was just a few years after he left the role, and Colin Baker was the current Doctor. Actually, with Colin Baker being the current Doctor, that would have to be, what, 1985, actually, when that interview probably was done. Well, 85, 84, it's at least 25 years old. Interesting, to say the least. Well, it's been a jam-packed show, this episode of Doctor Who Podshock, and we're going to wrap things up now. I want to thank everyone that was involved. Remember, visit our website, thegallifreyembassy.org or podshock.net. There's news and information there that gets posted in between our podcasts. You can follow Doctor Who Podshock on Twitter at twitter.com/podshock. And you can follow me as well, twitter.com/LewisTrapani. Ken Deep can be found at twitter.com/KenDeep. And I believe Jules Burt is at twitter.com/JulesBurt. As always, you can leave us feedback at feedback@podshock.net. So until next time, cheers, everyone. You have been listening to Doctor Who Podshock, presented by the fan-run GallifreyEmbassy.org. Doctor Who is owned and trademarked by the BBC. Doctor Who Podshock is not affiliated with the BBC in any way. Come back next time for another exciting and informative episode of Doctor Who Podshock. Doctor Who Podshock theme music by Jeff Smith at thejeffsmith.com. This has been a production of Art Trap Productions and is presented to you by the Gallifreyan Embassy and has been made possible in part by supporting subscribers and donations from listeners like you.
Doctor Who Podshock!
Goodbye. It's good, isn't it?
Hmm?